Accession number 30018, reel 13.
John Farley, reel 13. Were there, in this early stage with the undercarriage, you mentioned it, you weren't happy with it. Did it cause any specific problems?
Yes, the undercarriage caused great problems to start with. It stopped them, Bill Bedford and Hugh Merriweather, doing a decent vertical takeoff. I don't know how many goes it was before they got a vertical takeoff out of the aeroplane, but it was a number like 4 or 5 or 6 perhaps, because as the engine started to accelerate, they've put the nozzles down, you see, and they now place the throttle forward. As the engine started to accelerate, the aeroplane, it started to carry some of the weight of the aeroplane, and it rose up the oleos, and one wing or the other flopped down. So now there's a bit of sideways component to this thrust, and the aircraft just lurched sideways across the ground, because it's only got the friction of the wheels and so on, before it actually got in the air. So it was going out of control on the ground, and they had to throttle back, you know. So they put temporary outrigger extensions on to try and reduce this. But they couldn't stay on, because for the reasons that we first mentioned, you know. So, yes, there were real issues from the word go. Later, when we came to do something called a short takeoff, and we haven't discussed those, but a vertical takeoff is quite easy. You have to have more thrust than your weight, and if you haven't got more thrust than your weight, you won't leave the ground. Well, in those days, the weight of the aeroplane, or not those days, when the Harrier first went into service, the weight of the aeroplane was 12,500 pounds. And I'm talking empty weight. It could contain 5,000 pounds of fuel. So you put that in, and now you've got 17,500 pounds, if my maths is right. You could put about another 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of various bombs and weaponry on the outside. So now you've got an aeroplane up at about 21,000 or 22,000 pounds. The thrust of the engine was 19,000 pounds. So whilst you could do a vertical takeoff with full fuel, you couldn't take much in the way of weapons with you. If you wanted to take all the weapons, you couldn't take much in the way of fuel with you. So what are you going to do? Does that mean you throw the airplane away and say that's no good then? No, all your way to think of it is when you've got maximum fuel and maximum weapons, you're, shall we say, 2 tons too heavy to take off. That's all. You're not 8 tons too heavy to take off, you're 2 tons. And if you just run along the ground a bit until the wing is going through the air, not fast enough to lift the whole aeroplane, but just to provide a couple of tons of lift, if you now bang the nozzles down, the thing will jump into the sky on a mixture of jet lift and wing lift, mainly jet lift. And that was called a short takeoff. The corresponding thing of coming into land when you're too heavy to hover is called a slow landing. And you have a minimum speed associated with a slow landing, just like you have a minimum speed associated with an ordinary landing in an ordinary airliner at Heathrow. It happens that the minimum speed in a Harrier doing a slow landing is quite low, and so you don't need much strip, but you still need some speed if you're above your hover weight. So we had to teach pilots how to do short takeoffs, where you rush it on the ground with the nozzles aft, and then you yank the nozzle lever back at a pre-computed speed, where you knew from a graph that that's how much wing lift you would get, therefore you could carry the weight of your aeroplane today. And that graph actually has to also take into account the temperature of the day, because jet engines produce less thrust, don't they, on hot days and so on. But it was a very simple calculation. You just picture your nozzle down speed off a graph.
So when you were working with the P1127, was there some misinterpretation of the aircraft's potential, because people were the media, because I think they were interested at the time, were they interested in the idea that it could just take vertically off at any point? Although, as you've explained, it couldn't do. Was that the misapprehension about its capabilities?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So there were two classes of people outside those directly associated within the aeroplane, those that didn't understand it, and those that didn't want to allow it to happen. Remember, there's a big vested interest in the world out there from the manufacturers who make ordinary jet aeroplanes. They didn't want to see their market for all their ordinary aeroplanes vanish, and so it was in their interest, commercial interest, to poo-poo this silly thing as a little toy that couldn't carry a fag packet across a football pitch or whatever, you know. So there were people who were actively knocking the concept. And then there were people, some of them were so-called air correspondents in the press and so on, who didn't understand it and were just wrong and mistaken. Like the chap for the Daily Telegraph who used to say that it used so much fuel during a vertical takeoff that it couldn't go anywhere after that. Well, in fact, we were able to demonstrate, and I can explain to you quite easily how that, so we're able to demonstrate that you could take off vertically, accelerate onto your wings, accelerate to your cruising speed, and get onto the heading for your target using less fuel than if you took off conventionally and did the same thing. So it was the reverse was true. You actually used less fuel in doing a takeoff vertically than in doing one horizontally, if you choose to accept that the takeoff is a manoeuvre that starts with zero speed on the aeroplane and finishes up as quickly as you can do it with the aeroplane at its cruising speed pointing in the direction you want it to go. That complete manoeuvre is a takeoff. Well, usually, I mean, we set that description up to suit ourselves, of course, because usually a runway doesn't point in the direction you need to go. I mean, there's only one runway at Heathrow, you know, there's airfields scattered all over the world. So they've got to turn sooner or later after they leave the runway. Well, if you do a vertical takeoff, as you leave the ground, you just rotate the aeroplane until it is pointing directly where you want to go. And so you don't have that little extra distance where you have to turn. If you do a vertical takeoff, you don't have to taxi halfway around this great big NATO airfield, burning up fuel, to get to the end of the runway. You just lift off where you are. And so you were going to use less fuel doing it that way. Not much. I mean, the whole thing was probably going to involve 110, 115 pounds of fuel, which is sort of about 100 weight, which was a sack of coal at my coal man. I mean, people used to deliver coal for us to burn on our fires once, and they brought it in sacks and dumped it in a heap in your garden or in a shed. And, he would carry 112 pounds, a sack of coal, on his back. Well, that was about exactly the amount of fuel that you would use in doing a vertical takeoff, accelerating to wingborne speed, and accelerating to cruise, and so on. And you only have to multiply the number of seconds that this whole thing takes by the fuel flow in pounds per minute to realise what the number is. So the fact that we were 10 pounds of fuel less used than doing an old, neither here nor there, but it just demonstrates the fact that some people totally misunderstood the aeroplane. They never did get to grips with it.
Obviously, you brought the P1127 back from Dunsfold, and you'd done your working up on it. What was the program that you started working on then? What was the things that you started to compare?
Oh, very dull stuff. In terms of, if you expect me to say, you know, it was dangerous and difficult and all the rest of it. When I say dull, a lot of research is dull. If we watch our television and look at the crime dramas, there are coppers who say it's all down to the detail of the work we do. Well, that's what research flying is about. It's about the detail. It's about accurately flying manoeuvres to some specific description that the Buffin has given you in terms of G or angle of attack or speed or height or weight, and you're just collecting data so that they can draw all their graphs and therefore predict the performance of the aeroplane outside where you've actually flown it, because they can extrapolate graphs and so on. There was a lot of measurement of the ground effect of the aeroplane. What happens to these jets when they hit the ground and splash about on during a takeoff or a landing? How hot are the tyres going to get, rubber tyres under the aeroplane? What sort of damage is it going to do to the surface? You know, all these sort of thoughts. And then there was the aerodynamics of the flying machine, not the jump jet, the wings and tail, the traditional stuff. They wanted to know exactly what those were, as they did with the Handley Page 115 or anything else. And you know, when you're flying to collect that sort of data, it is, on the face of it, extremely dull and repetitive stuff where you're covering different speeds, heights, throttle settings, nozzle angles was an extra thing on this aeroplane, side slip angles, angles of attack, you know, and running the recorders or making manuscript notes. It's a lot of dull, boring groundwork. And that a lot of research flying is like that. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly in that to fly this little aeroplane was never dull. But, you know, it's not the actual nature of the flying was not spectacular in the way that some people might imagine it to be. It's actually dull and repetitious and detailed.
So the stage you kind of joined the project, had they reached a level where they knew it worked, but then they needed to know really the parameters through which the aircraft would work? Is that the right
yeah,
stage that you're
really at? I think so. And in particular, the Bedford part of the act. I mean, Hawkers at Dunsfold were trying to develop a jet fighter that could take off and land vertically and they could sail around the world, and they did. That wasn't the task at Bedford. The task at Bedford was to understand thoroughly this vector thrust concept, what its advantages were and what its disadvantages were, and also to thoroughly understand the SC-1 lift jet type concept, what its advantages were and disadvantages. So that when Bedford, as a government scientific institution, or the RAE was, and Bedford was part of it, was asked their view on which was the right way to go, was it the Hawker way to go or the Rolls-Royce and Short way to go, you know, they would be able to stand up and argue the corner. So Bedford's role as a research organisation was always that. And right up to the time, not when I left it, but when it shut in 1990-something. I mean, the last time I flew at Bedford in a Harrier was 1993. I had retired as Harrier Chief Test Pilot in 1983. So I had been retired 10 years when they asked me to go back to Bedford and have a look at some modification on another Harrier that they'd got to there, because they had me calibrated and they want, you know, as an individual, they wanted my view on this. So Bedford's role was always about research. It was about finding out the facts behind everything and trying to make decent predictions and really understand what we're about. Dunsfold's role was to, can we make it good enough and can we sell it? Not quite the same thing.
So you've done quite a lot of research on the two aircraft. What was kind of the next stage for you with that, after that level?
Well, as project pilot on the P-1127, I was very fortunate, as I said. I thought it was the best job in the United Kingdom. But that wasn't the only thing I was doing at Bedford. I was participating in all of the other programmes, one or two of them in a quite minor way, because I was majoring, as it were, on the P-1127. But I did actually participate in all the other programmes at Bedford, and there were lots of them. And, you know, you could you could write a book about that whole thing. I mean, they range from things like thunderstorm research, thunderstorm penetration, clear air turbulence research, the Concorde stuff, a thing called the jet flap. It was another way of flying slowly. The Hunting 126 jet flap, which is now in the museum at Cosford. There was the SB5, which was a variable sweepback thing that looked like a 7/8 scale Lightning, and the wings could be fitted using a spanner at three different angles. You didn't have a lever in the cockpit, so you had to pick an angle before you took off. And, you know, there was this sort of fundamental research going on, and I was... We were doing steep approaches. We were trying to understand how aircraft could be got into shorter strips. Ordinary airplanes, we had an Andover, for example, which was a turboprop transport airplane that the Royal Air Force had at the time. Things like that that we were looking at steep approaches with. There were a whole range of things going on, and that was Bedford's task as a research organisation. But I gradually, by the end of my tour, which was 3 years, I had certainly specialised in the jump jet thing. Now, Bill Bedford was due to retire in 1966, because the retirement age in those days was 45, and he'd reached it. And so Hawkers were looking for a young lad to put in the bottom of the test flying team. The test flying team had been Bedford, Merriweather and Simpson. And Bedford's going out the top, they need to put somebody in the bottom. Well, the number of people who'd flown jump jets was fairly small, and so I was obviously well placed to get the job. And I went down and was interviewed, and I got the job. And I took off my blue suit and became a civilian pilot for Hawker Siddeley Aviation, as it was. Again, it may be strange to youngsters today in the 21st century, but we could not leave the services in those days because you wanted to. There was something called premature voluntary retirement or something these days, PVR. You can ask to leave the services now, and you may have to work off an extra 9 months or 14 months or something according to your training and job and filling your slot and so on, but you can go. Wasn't the case. I was in for good. I was in to 55, and I couldn't get out before 55, at least unless I was court-martialed or went sick. So how was industry going to get its test pilots? The only real source of them was from the Royal Air Force. How else were they going to have test pilots who understood what the Royal Air Force needed with aeroplanes unless they got these out? So there was an Air Ministry order, because it wasn't a Ministry of Defence then, it was an Air Ministry and a Board of the Admiralty and so on. They were separate. There was an Air Ministry order that allowed appropriate civilian organisations to apply to the Air Ministry for release of an individual against a specific requirement. And so Hawkers, having decided they would like me with a normal selection process, they then approached the Air Ministry and said they wanted to have Yank Farley out of the Air Force under the terms of whatever. And so off I went, and by September 1967 I'm now sitting in my office at Dunsfold, having left the Royal Air Force.
What was the first thing that you became involved in when you got down to Dunsfold?
There were several things going on. Remember, I'm the junior guy now. There was some Hunter flying that was still to be done. I certainly did that. There was communication flying to be done, and I certainly did that. But there was also Harrier test flying to be done, and I joined in on that. In fact, I remember one of the jobs I got was to do the maximum weight short takeoff from a grass strip. When we were developing the Harrier, we had to meet what were called spec points. The contract for the Harrier meant that the aircraft had to pull 6G, 400 knots, 10,000 pounds. Sorry, 10,000 feet at 16,800 pounds weight, for example. The numbers get burned into your head. And we had to pull 6G under those circumstances. There was another point where we had to get the maximum weight of the aeroplane, that's with its, and its short takeoff mode, off a certain type of bumpy strip. And they had been gradually increasing the weight, and now they got to the point where they had to do the spec point, which was another 10 knots faster, you know, with the extra weight on, and that, and if we could put a tick in the box. So I was given that point to do, and I thought, well, that's a privilege, isn't it? Wrong. I was set up. And as I taxied out, I thought, hey, hang on, hang about a minute. This is jolly bumpy here, because I'm backtracking on this rough grass strip. And I thought, it's not going to be very easy to read this airspeed indicator when we're doing nearly 100 knots over the grass, and I've got to pick exactly the right speed to meet the spec point to put the nozzles down. I thought, I've been set up here. This is I'm going to make a mess of this. And then as I was thinking, there was a damn great bang, and the nose fell on the ground, and I thought, well, that's wrong. So, and the nose leg had broken off, and so I stopped the engine and opened the cockpit and got out and things, and I was interested in whether the leg had broken off or whether it had retracted, you know, because of a fall. But anyhow, so I suddenly, perhaps it was just as well, I might have made an idiot of myself if we'd actually got to put the speed, the nozzles down at some high speed on that bumpy ground. Anyhow, this was a fatigue failure in the gear, you know. So, yeah, I was involved from the beginning, and I mentioned...
Could I just ask you about that, John, with that? When you said you couldn't read the... Would that say that you physically couldn't read it
because
of the amount of
bouncing
that was going around on the ground?
Yeah. The specification for the rough ground was a soldier could just keep control of a Land Rover that he was driving across it at 40 miles an hour. So you can imagine, you know, how some soldiers are prepared to thrash across a farmer's field at 40 miles an hour in a Land Rover. It could be quite rough, and you're hanging, you've got the steering wheel to hang on to, you know, Well, that gave you quite a physically rough ride, even in a Harrier. And so, yes, the question was, you know, with your eyeballs all shaking in the sockets and everything, will you be able to read this thing properly? So, you know, but that's it's a minor detail.
And the fatigue failure, was that anything to do with the trials that you were taking
place? No, it wasn't, actually. There was a fault with a batch of the nose legs, and for various reasons. I had the first one that failed. I was lucky, because it broke about a foot down from the top, and so there was a spike of nose leg sticking out underneath the nose, which went donk into the grass. The second chap it happened to was Mike Adams. Now, Mike Adams was the guy who had been with me at ETPS, the chap who won the pot and came top and had gone to Boscombe. It happened to Mike when he was taxiing a Harrier at Dunsfold as part of the Boscombe evaluation of the aeroplane, and he was on a hard taxiway. And so when the same failure happened to him, this stub of leg went donk onto the ground, and he broke his back. I mean, compression fracture. I mean, I don't mean to sound dramatic, but it was a very painful business, and he was offline for some time. And wasn't I lucky, you know, that it happened on grass with me? No, it wasn't anything to do with a particular test exercise. It was just one of those things.
And you said they'd increased the weight on the aircraft. How had they done that? Was it, because obviously, was it with dummy weapons, or...?
Oh, yes. When we... For flight test purposes, not just jump jets, any sort of flight test purpose, you need to vary the weight of the aeroplane. From the lightest weight that the designers intended ever fly at, to the heaviest weight that is ever intended. And you're going to move progressively, and you're going to vary the weight according to the weather circumstances and stuff like that. It's part of the... it's part of plotting all the graphs with your flight test data that you've got to have all these variables that you are to cover so that when the aircraft is in service, there is no point that it might fly at where it hasn't been tested at it. So you are always varying the fuel state, or if you have got the ability to put external stores on, varying those as well. We chose to use tanks rather than bombs where possible, because you can put the half a tank full of fuel in, you see. When you put a £1,000 bomb on, then your weight's gone up £1,000, and you might have to take £500 of fuel out if the increment you wanted was £500. So yes, eventually we were going to be carrying around iron bombs and so on. I mean, bombs, inert bombs were the preferred way because they were so dense.
And this testing, obviously this specification for rough ground, was that continued, or was that something that couldn't be met, or was it met?
Oh no, it was. We had to meet all the spec points, and they were met. There were some specification points in the first Harrier contract which were perfectly normal and were there for the Hunter, for example, the previous jet aeroplane sort of thing. But there were a few other spec points which were totally abnormal. And because it was this new V-stall thing, and because it was supposed to be able to operate from a farmer's field as well. I mean, two examples will be enough. One was this short takeoff from a rough strip. Another was, go and stand the Harrier in the middle of that grass surface over there, and we want you to import in two helicopters the team and the engine and do an engine change in that field, literally field, without any equipment that you don't bring in the helicopters. And you've got to do it in 4 hours, okay? There was another spec point, purely associated with this new jump jet thing. So the aircraft had to be designed to meet that. You don't design an airplane and then say, oh, you want to change the engine in a field in 4 hours? Oof, how are we going to do that? You know, the aircraft was, from the word go, designed to meet that point. For example, I mentioned that if you lifted the wing off, and it was held on with 6 bolts, if you lifted the wing off, you had this huge hole. So now you can lift the engine out. Fine. So all you had to do now was to develop a crane that could be brought into the field in one of the helicopters, a Meccano crane, each piece of which mustn't weigh more than 200 pounds so that two blokes can lug it about. And the crane took the form of a U. Imagine a large U, I don't know, 15 feet legs, 10 feet base. And this was made up of girders, and there were little tiny caster wheels on the corners, and there were bits of girder, I mean, they were aluminium, you know, it was sort of aircraft standard stuff. But you built this U-frame out of chunks, and it clipped together, not with Meccano nuts and bolts, but with pit pins, you know, that you just pushed in. So you could quickly make this U out of bits of aluminium girder that were in one helicopter. And on top of that U, you mounted a sort of tripod-like set. Well, there were four legs that went up, and you put a pulley on the top. And now you could push this U under the wings, the legs of it. So you've now got a skyhook, as it were, a crane, over the top of the engine bay. Does that make sense? And you could winch the engine out of the aeroplane. In order to steady the aeroplane with the wing off, you had trestle-type things that were put underneath, you know, wooden things, and so you stabilise the fuselage, you push this wing, this U thing, and the crane underneath it, you lifted the wing off, and each little wheel on the crane at the corners of the U had a handle on it, and so you put a bloke on each handle, and you wound the crane out with the wing on the top and dumped it on the grass, and then you picked the engine up out of its box, And the new engine came in a crate, which was split halfway around the its depth. And so you lifted the top off the box and put it on the floor. That's now the base to take your old engine. The new engine is lifted out with a crane and you wind it, you know, and having taken the old engine out and dumped it in the box. So you have to think that sort of thing through. It's not going to happen by accident. So that's an example of a couple of spec points. I think we did it in 3 hours 80.